The lookout tried to make himself as small as possible, for they were crowded together in the canvas bucket, and he pointed out the ship to his captain.
There she be, sir.
Black Joke's role was emphasized up here on the tall pendulum of the mast, and the horizon swung giddily through the field of Clinton's telescope as he tried to keep it focused. It was an art that he had never completely mastered, but that was of little consequence. For the first time, the little regular white pyramids popped up in the field of his glass. The last doubts were dispelled, and Clinton felt his heart leap fiercely against his ribs. His voice was strangled with triumphant emotion as he shouted down at the tiny foreshortened figures on the gleaming white quarterdeck far below. "Bring her round to due east, Mr. Denham. Order a full head of steam on the boiler." Though he had not yet fully recovered his breath, he threw himself out of the crow's nest and scrambled down faster than he had climbed. In his haste, he slid the last 50 feet down the backstay and barely noticed the rough hempen rope scorching the palms of his hands. By the time his feet hit the deck, Black Joke was coming around onto her new heading, and in anticipation of Clinton's next order, Denham had already called the watch below, and they came boiling out onto the deck. "And we will clear for action, Mr. Denham, if you please," gasped Clinton, his face dark with blood under his deep water tan, and the sapphire eyes alight with battle lust. All Black Joke's officers carried swords on their belts. Only Clinton had selected a cutlass, for he preferred the stouter and heavier weapon. And he fiddled with the hilt, even now, as he spoke to them quietly and seriously. "Gentlemen, I have documented proof that the ship ahead of us has a cargo of slaves aboard her." Denham coughed nervously, and Clinton forestalled him. "I am also aware that she is an American vessel, and in ordinary circumstances we would be helpless to oppose her passage." Denham nodded with relief, but Clinton went on remorselessly. "However, I have received an appeal from one of Her Majesty's subjects, Dr. Robin Ballantyne, whom you all know well, who is being abducted aboard the Huron against her will. I am certain what my duty is in these circumstances. I intend to board her, and if she resists me, I intend to fight her." He paused, and their faces were shocked, strained. "Those of you who have objections to this course of action should immediately note them in the ship's log, and I will sign them." Their relief and gratitude was immediate. Few other captains would be so lenient. He signed his name neatly beneath the entry in the ship's log, and then returned the pen to its holder. "Now that the formalities have been seen to, gentlemen, shall we get on with earning our hire?" And Clinton was smiling for the first time since they sailed from Zanzibar Harbour, as he indicated the pile of snowy white sails that was now clearly visible from the deck ahead of Black Joke's bows. And as he spoke, there was an eruption of dark, tarry-smelling smoke from the tall single stack above them, and the engine telegraph clanged sharply as the pointer moved to engine standing by position on the repeater. Black Joke had steam in her boiler. Clinton stepped to the telegraph, thrust the handle fully around the dial to the full ahead position, and the deck vibrated under his feet as the propeller shaft began to spin, and Black Joke lunged forward eagerly, breaking the swells off her shoulders in explosions of white spray.
"By God, he's got us pinned against the land," Mungo drawled the words out nonchalantly, even smiling slightly at Tipu, as he lowered the glass from his eye for a moment and polished the lens on his shirt sleeve. "We'll have to run like the very devil to get around him and make the open sea, Mr. Tipu. Will you be good enough to shake out every last reef and crack on all the sail we can carry right up to the skysails?"
He lifted the glass to his eye again as Tipu began bellowing the orders. "It's a little bit too much luck for any one man," Mungo murmured aloud. "It's too much coincidence that the one man I would not wish to meet by lying in the one place on all the oceans where I would not wish to meet him." Again he lowered the glass and strode to the poop rail to look down onto the main deck. Robin Ballantyne was at the ship's side, staring out across the indigo-blue waters at the sail and the smear of dark smoke still far out to sea, but every moment converging on them, headed to a point far ahead of Huron's elegant bows, where the courses of the two ships would meet. She sensed Mungo's eyes upon her, and she lifted the shawl off her head
so that her dark russet hair tumbled out and snapped and danced around her cheeks. Her skirts were flattened against her legs by the wind, so that she had to lean slightly forward to balance herself. She lifted her chin and stared up at Mungo, her expression defiant, and she watched him as he carefully bit the end off one of his long, thin black cheroots and cupped his hands around the sulphurous flare of the Vesta match and lit the cheroot without once breaking the steady gaze that held her own. Then he sauntered easily down the poop ladder to her side. "A friend of yours, Dr. Ballantyne?" The smile was on his lips alone. His eyes were frosty. "I have prayed every night for him to come, ever since I sent the letter that summoned him." "You do not deny the betrayal?" "I am proud I was able to perform my Christian duty." "Who carried your letter?" "No member of your crew, sir. I sent it by the master of the Omani Bagaloo." "I see." His voice was low, but stinging as dry ice. "And what of Tipu's illness? Would a physician, perchance, stoop to poisoning a patient?" She dropped her eyes, unable to meet that accusation. "Will you be so kind, Dr. Ballantyne, as to return to your cabin immediately and stay there until I give you permission to leave it? There will be an armed guard at the door."
"I am to be punished?"
"No man would blame me for dropping you over the side and leaving you to be picked up by your countrymen. However, it is your safety I'm thinking of. This deck could become an unhealthy spot in the very near future, and we will all be too much occupied to care for you." His attention left her, and he was staring ahead and then glancing back at Black Joke's smoke, judging speeds and angles with a seaman's eye. Then he smiled.
"Before you go, I would like you to know that all your efforts have really been a fine waste of time. Look there."
He pointed ahead along the sheer and mountainous coastline, and following his arm, she saw for the first time that ahead of them the sea was as black and broken as new coal cut from the face, glittering with wild jumping wavelets, each flecked with pretty white crests.
"There is the wind," Mungo said. "That's where it comes through the mountains, and we will be into it before you are safely tucked up in your cabin."
He chuckled now, comfortably, confidently.
"Once we get on that wind, there are few ships on all the oceans, either steam or sail, that would match Huron for a moment. And God knows there are none who could run her down."
He gave her a small, mocking bow, parody of gracious southern manners.
"Take a good look at that ugly little steam packet before you go, ma'am. You'll not be seeing her again. And now, if you'll be good enough to excuse me."
He turned from her and ran lightly back up the poop ladder. Tears of anger dimming her eyes, Robin clutched the sail and stared across the narrowing strip of sea at the bustling, puffing little gunboat. Already she could catch glimpses of the hull and its painted checkerboard gunports. She began to hope that Mungo St. John's boast had been mere bravado, for Black Joke seemed to be keeping pace with the tall clipper. The wind was still a long, long way ahead. There was a respectful touch on Robin's shoulder, and old Nathaniel stood beside her.
"Captain's orders, ma'am, and I am to see you safe in your cabin."
Clinton leaned forward, all his weight on the balls of his feet, almost as though he were trying to urge his ship on by the balance of his body, the way a rider leans forward into the jump. He also had seen the wind pattern on the surface of the sea, and knew what it heralded. The tall clipper ship looked lazy now, indolent in her flounces and ruffles, as a lady of high fashion, and Black Joke was snorting and snuffling busily down the short leg of the triangle. If they both maintained the speed and course, they would meet about 11 nautical miles ahead. Clinton could visualize the exact spot clearly, just beyond the spit of land marked on his chart as Buckoven Point. Huron was committed to her present course. She could not bear up, for the land lay close under her weather rail, and the chart showed breaking shoals well offshore. There was one of them now, close onto her starboard beam, showing its round black granite back and blowing like a whale. Huron was in a trap, and her only escape would be to find the extra turn of speed, which would carry her away out of gunshot range.
And there it was, the wind, less than 3 miles ahead of her. There was a loud banging from the deck below Clinton's feet, and he glanced irritably at Ferris. "See what that is," he snapped, and turned his full attention back to the clipper. 3 short miles she had to go, but even as Clinton stared at her through his glass, he saw her huge square mainsail quiver and then shake gently as she luffed in the fluky airs below the mountains. "Please God," Clinton whispered, and Huron's speed bled off perceptibly. All her sails were losing their taut, clean shape, and she checked away, balking like a weary animal. "She's found a hole in the wind," Lieutenant Denham called exultantly. "We've got her now, by God." "I'll thank you not to blaspheme on this quarter-deck, Mr. Denham," Clinton told him sharply, and Denham's expression was instantly crestfallen. "I beg your pardon, sir." At that moment, Ferris arrived breathlessly back on deck. "The stokers, sir," he panted. "They're knocking out all the furniture from the officers' quarters. Your bunk's gone, sir, and your desk also." Clinton barely glanced at him. He was studying the clipper, evaluating each yard of difference in their speeds, judging as finely as he dared the angle of his interception. Yes, he decided. With Huron's loss of speed, he could edge in a touch more. "Bring her up a point to starboard," he told the helmsman. And then he glanced up at his own sails that were helping the big bronze screws under the stern to hurl Black Joke forward. The alteration, of course, had affected them. "Mr. Ferris, see to the trim of your jib, if you please." Ferris bellowed an order to the foredeck watch and watched critically as they hardened up the long triangular sail. All Huron's sails shivered and then refilled, once more taking on their true shape, and she spurted away, a curl of white sparkling under her bows. The dark, windswept water was much closer ahead of her. It had been Denham's unnecessary blasphemy, Clinton was sure of it, and he glanced darkly at his lieutenant, and then reluctantly gave the order. "Let her fall off a point." Huron was head-reaching again. If Black Joke held on, she would be aiming to cut behind the clipper's stern. The alteration was an acknowledgement of the advantage changing hands once again. The engine voice pipe squealed, and it was a relief to have even that small distraction. "Engine room, Captain," he snapped into the mouthpiece. "Coal long ago gone, sir. Pressure down to 100 pounds, sir, and falling. Burn everything you can find. Wood goes up like paper, sir. No body to it, and it chokes the flue." MacDonald seemed to relish the gloomy news, and Clinton felt his irritation turn to anger. "Do your best, man. Nobody can ask for more than that." And he snapped the voice pipe closed. Was he close enough yet to try a shot with his bow chaser, he wondered. The long 16-pounder had almost twice the range of the big 32-pounders that made up Black Joke's main armament. A lucky shot might carry away one of the clipper's spars, might even bring down a yard. And at that moment he distinctly felt the change in the engine vibrations coming up through the deck. Black Joke was faltering, the steam in her boilers losing pressure. "Mr. Ferris, break out the colours, if you please." As the ensign unfurled at the peak, spread gloriously against the pale blue sky, crimson and silky white, shouting a challenge on the wind, Clinton felt that tightness in his chest, that swell of pride which never failed him. "Huron's replying," Denham muttered, and Clinton lifted his glass and watched the American's colours bloom like a flower high above her, shimmering piles of white canvas. "And be damned," Denham interpreted the show of colours. Huron was scorning their challenge. "Mr. Ferris, we'll give her a gun now," Clinton decided grimly. "Put one over her bows." And Ferris scrambled away to the bows to supervise the loading and laying of the bow chaser.